Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, Ellen here. Welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I am back from my flying visit last week to Sydney for the PAFAO Sydney 20 event. And we've just had a long weekend here in Victoria as well. And both of these events have got me thinking about well-being and how we do it. So firstly, PAFAO Sydney 20 was great. We heard some fascinating case studies from workplaces who are using data about how people work to improve the way we do work and their work experience, or our experience of work, I suppose. And one example was Microsoft, who, as part of transforming their workplaces, looked at meeting culture. Now, Microsoft have a couple of productivity analytics tools. There's an individual one called My Analytics, which you might have access to if you work particularly for a large organisation. And then they have a tool called Workplace Analytics that can gather information from a range of Microsoft applications within an organisation. So they were interested in meeting culture. So what was happening with meetings in their workplace, and were they being effective? Were they effective use of time? So they used this workplace analytics data within this one part of their business to see when people booked meetings. And they noticed that meetings could and were being booked at absolutely any time of day, all day, every week. Now, these are internal meetings. And of course, one of the things we know about productivity, and Microsoft know this too, and of course, well-being, is that if we never get a chance to get deep into a task because of interruptions or constant meetings, it's very hard for our brain to be its most productive and creative. So as human beings, we just need time and space to go deep and think broadly in order to really make progress on our meaningful tasks and goals. And the benefit of that is that we then get that feeling of achievement when we're able to tick tasks off our list and feel like we're doing things at our best. So Microsoft had noticed this pattern in this particular part of their business, that internal meetings were happening all over the shop. And they decided that that wasn't the most effective thing to do, both for productivity and just for the well-being of their people. So they made a plan that internal meetings would only take place on Monday mornings and Friday mornings. And that freed up other time to go deep into tasks without interruptions, to increase the opportunity for innovation, which is pretty cool, really. And we heard plenty of other examples over the PAFAO event of how workplaces are using data, so gathering information about human behaviour in the workplace, in order to make changes to improve effectiveness and our experience of work. And then we here in Victoria had a long weekend, on the weekend as well, the one just gone. And given my husband and I had both been awake during the week prior, we decided that we weren't going to go anywhere for the long weekend. But I still felt really strongly that a long weekend is just a good chance for a proper break to, you know, do the same thing as we're just talking about with regard to meetings. You're going to give you a chance to just relax and think about different things and not be working and doing the day-to-day all the time. So I told the kids that we were having a staycation over the long weekend, and rather than just hang about and get absorbed into the everyday chores like the grocery shopping and the cleaning and whatever else, I created a holiday agenda that involved some time at our wonderful Ballarat Begonia Festival. So that was the first thing, which is a fabulous garden and community-oriented festival that also involves some pretty great food and wine and lots of kids' activities. And then there's also been sunflower picking in Dunstown, which is a little township nearby to Ballarat. And as a family, a trip to Melbourne Zoo at my 8-year-old's request. And then a heap of other things that were, A, things that we could do together as a family, B, were largely outdoors, to the fresh air and the well-being benefits that that brings. C, were community-based. And D, were things that we just wouldn't ordinarily do. And so both this long weekend experience and the stories that I heard at the PFAO event reminded me of the importance of really being proactive about our well-being at home and at work. We just shouldn't leave it to chance. We need to focus and prioritise it. We need to pay attention and take action. And that's exactly what I'm talking about with my guest today as well. We're talking about prioritising positivity in our lives, not just leaving it to chance. So let's listen into that, shall we? Joining me today on the show is one of Australia's leading positive psychologists, Dr. Susie Green. Susie is a clinical and coaching psychologist, the founder and CEO of the Positivity Institute, a positively deviant organisation dedicated to the research and application of positive psychology for life, school and work. And she's the author of a brand new book, The Positivity Prescription, which is what she's here to talk to us about today. Welcome, Susie.
Thank you, Ellen. Thanks for having me back.
Excited to be here. It really is welcome back because this is the second time you've appeared on the show, which is lovely. Yep. We recorded an interview way, way, way back. I think it was perhaps one of the first episodes of the show. So it's lovely to have you back and to be able to continue our conversation, particularly as it pertains to this brand new book, The Positivity Prescription, which the subtitle, I should give that as well, is a 6-week well-being program based on the science of positive psychology. And Susie, you say right at the beginning of the Positivity Prescription that the aim of the book is to equip readers with the skills to manage life's curveballs and boost their mood and create a flourishing life. So I want to start by asking, what does it mean to flourish?
Yes, the F word, Ellen, we call it. look, there's still a bit of debate. I was only giving a presentation yesterday. There's still some scientific debate, as you would know, as to how we formally define it, how we measure it. There's a really simple way that I think Professor Felicia Huppert from Cambridge Institute of Wellbeing refers to, which is feeling good and functioning well. I'd probably add even feeling good, doing good and functioning well, and unless doing good is part of the functioning well. So that's a really simple way to think about it. Some of the more complex ways are to look at mental health and wellbeing on a spectrum from low levels of mental health, mental illness, right through to high levels of mental health and wellbeing, which we are referring to as a flourishing state. And another way is to look at mental health and wellbeing on one axis and then engagement, if you like, or performance on another axis. So when we sort of lay them over each other, and the bottom, it's a sort of four box, if you like, the bottom left is what we call distressed and dysfunctional. And that's probably more the clinical realm, where I spent many years treating people with clinical disorders, psychological disorders. Then where you've got sort of low levels of well-being but high levels of engagement. Ellen, you and I deal with people like that every single day in the workplace and in the education sector. So highly engaged, find their work really meaningful, but often to the detriment of their well-being. So that's certainly a place where we spend a lot of time. Up in the top left hand, high levels of well-being, upper levels of engagement, coasting or plodding, it's often referred to. I don't particularly think there's anything wrong or bad with that. I know there's been times in my life when I've been happy to coast or plod, but the ideal, or the suggestion for the ideal, is that it's a combination then of high levels of well-being and engagement, which refers to a flourishing state of well-being.
Fabulous. So that, and I do love that Felicia Huppert's description as well, because I think that probably is, you know, using perhaps our layperson terms for that quadrant that you're talking about. So we're feeling good, we're doing good, which I guess is that engagement piece, is it? That's, you know, how we're actually functioning and operating in our work, in our careers, in our life.
Yeah, and I guess I use the analogy a lot, like if your glass is full and you've invested in your well-being, it just becomes a tip if you're trying to assist others, just a small tip from a full glass. But if you're half full, it's very destabilizing and very hard. But as you probably know, positive psychology has been criticized in the early days as being very individualistic and all about me, me, me. For me, and I know for you, Ellen, it's never been about that. It's ultimately about this concept that when I'm full and flourishing, I can do more in the world and help the people around me and create this positive ripple effect.
Yeah, it is. That's a conversation I do find I have with a lot of people as well, this idea of having to, you know, you've got to put your air mask on first before you can help other people, which is the same idea of that, you know, if your cup is full, if your bucket is full and you are functioning at your best, you are happy, you are calm, you are managing your mood, you are engaged in what you're doing, then you do have that little bit extra to give to other people. But it's not that common, is it? What percentage of the population are we estimating now are flourishing?
Yeah, I probably need to do a little bit updated research, but a famous study, the MIDAS study in the US, showed that it was less than 20% of people that were flourishing according to those four categories that I mentioned before. There was also a study done with an adolescent population in Adelaide, I can't remember how many years ago it was now, and they also found similar results that our adolescent population, less than 20%, are truly flourishing. What I think is going to happen over the forthcoming years is we're going to get a little bit more clarity around what is flourishing and is it a state or how often does it fluctuate? And I've been giving this a lot of thought because I generally perceive myself to be a flourishing person, but I've got a few challenges on at the moment. I've got elderly parents and I've got a daughter that's just had a baby. I'm in the sandwich generation that's referred to. I'm growing a business. And so my well-being from time to time, I'm noticing it's not as consistent as it has been. And I think that's pretty normal. And that's the message that I'd like to take to people. And again, as a clean cycle, I've never sent the message that it's normal to be happy all the time with that big yellow smiley face, that we do have fluctuations in our emotions and our mood state depending on the circumstances that are happening in our life. So I think we're going to possibly get a little bit more clarity around this state of flourishing, because I think the last thing we want to do is set people up for disappointment or failure that, you know, when they do have a bad day that they can start thinking, oh, I'm not flourishing, when in fact they might be overarching state of flourishing and there's a lot of ways to measure that, but maybe it's just a brief fluctuation over a few days but they're less likely to potentially go down to a state of distress, if you like.
And do you think, and this really probably leads us into the book as a toolkit really, do you think that, because, you know, what you've just described exactly resonates for me as well. You know, when I ask groups who here thinks they're flourishing, yes, I always put my hand up and say, I'd say for the most part, but from day to day or week to week, or there are periods where life is difficult, you know, you perhaps not even sleeping well, and that's having an impact on your mood and your ability to manage your mood and your time, or lots of stuff, big and small, happens in life that makes things difficult. So do you think that perhaps once we've developed some of the skills for flourishing, you know, we've actually learnt the process, it becomes easier to manage those, you know, we've got that toolkit to draw on when times are difficult?
I absolutely know that. I guess from experience myself, I know when I've got to wind up perhaps my gratitude practice, which I don't necessarily feel the need to do that every day. I did that about 20 years ago and it significantly changed my life. But I'm at a point now where I'm a much more grateful person. I notice things, I appreciate things much more consciously than I ever did. But I know when I'm going through tougher times that that's something that I would revert to, and I would more explicitly pull out my journal and do that. But often we find, again, as you'd be very well aware of, Ellen, that often people drop the very activities that they should actually be winding up when they're stressed, for example, exercise. And also when you're in a very challenging situation, I've just been fortunate to only have been in possibly one or two of those in my life so far, nothing really, really traumatic. But when you're in the eye of the storm, my experience has been, even as a very experienced practitioner, it's very hard to apply your knowledge to yourself. And so for me, this is why getting this information and skills out to as many people as possible, so that you're surrounded by people that have the skills that can support you when you actually can't support yourself. So they often show the lessons from geese video. For anyone listening, you can Google it. It's a bit of a NAF leadership video they play in leadership development courses, and it talks about how geese fly in a V formation, and when one goose is not well or, you know, is dropping back out of the V formation, another one or two geese will drop back to help it and bring it forward or to take it away if it needs to leave the V. And for me, that's a great analogy, that the more of us that are surrounded with the skills to support people when they can't actually support themselves, you know, no matter how skilled they are, that, you know, again, that we've got people around us to help us there.
Yeah, that is a wonderful analogy, actually. And it does bring to mind, I suppose, the work that we both do in organisations, but also the work that particularly you and the team at the Positivity Institute do within schools. And yes. I've had this conversation with a number of our colleagues that if we can create an environment, that container that we operate in, whether that's a family or a school or a workplace or even just a community, where we have this language, these skills, these abilities and understanding to kind of, you know, remind people, maybe this is time to get your journal out, or maybe this is a good time to go for a walk, or, you know, all of that practical stuff that, yeah, because when you're in it, deep in it, it's really hard to A, remind yourself or even see that that's what you need, or yes. to then find the mental space or maybe the motivation to make it happen.
That's right. Yeah. And I guess even in a school setting where it might potentially be ritualized, which some schools are doing, like every Thankful Thursday. So there's an opportunity for students to stop and reflect on the things that they appreciate as well. So I think a really important message is it's the system, and the system, which can be tricky depending on how large your organisation is, but the system, the policies and the procedures ideally needs to support wellbeing, not undermine it. But in many cases, they are actively undermining people's wellbeing. So we usually have a very explicit conversation around, if you're very serious about skilling your people up with the wellbeing and resilience skills, then you need to take a good hard look at your systems and structures and policies and procedures to see if they're supporting or potentially undermining what we're trying to achieve.
Mm. And the role of the leaders too, and what they're modelling.
Absolutely. Very
That's
important.
A particular one for me.
Absolutely.
Let's come back to the book and this toolkit, because this is really what it is, isn't it? It's a program, it's a set of tools that is really, I've had a look at the book, very straightforward, simple to understand, lovely, simple language, not too sciencey.
Yeah.
Although it's always a challenge trying to find, you know, bring in enough of the science to really show the rigor that's behind it without making it sound like an academic paper, which we all know are tedious and nobody really reads. And a lot of your own personal stories too. So why write the book? You know, you've kind of alluded to it, but what was the driving force for you?
Well, I think it's around 20 years since I started as, I guess, an intern psychologist. And, you know, I've been on this incredible journey as a psychologist in various forms over the last 20 something years. But even prior to that, I was on a bit of a self-help journey in my sort of early 20s, which sort of, you know, coincided then with my scientific study of psychology. And I've worked with hundreds of people. I'm not currently doing any individual work because I'm growing the business, but I've worked with over 500 individual clients. A lot of those were clinical clients in a psychiatric setting or clinical psych setting or counselling, and also many, many coaching clients. And that could be personal coaching, life coaching, but I did 10 years of executive coaching as well. So I guess I had the wonderful opportunity to apply my knowledge of the science, and not just the positive psychological science, but psychological science more broadly. So you really get a chance to see what works, what doesn't. And it certainly depends on who you've got sitting in front of you and who you're working with as to what you might utilize or apply. And then, you know, having, I guess, been a bit of a passionate, you know, lover of science over the last 20 years and having taught at Sydney Uni positive psych for 10 years, I was in a sense forced to know the science if I was going to teach it. I say force, but I have love of learning as one of my top strengths and curiosity. So I just read this stuff, I think you're the same, Ellen, just for fun in any way. So I guess I've got the knowledge of the science, but I think even more so what comes out in the book is my experience as a practitioner. So I'm not just talking from what the academic text says, I'm actually talking about how it looks like in people's real lives. And so I've done lots of keynotes, workshops, in schools and workplaces. And for a long time, I've wanted to write a book for the general public. I've actually published over 20 peer-reviewed scientific articles and chapters in academic texts, but I really wanted to write a book for the general public. And so the positivity prescription is it, Ellen.
That is indeed.
Yeah.
Before you talk us through the bits of the book, because we did touch on this a little as well, but we're talking about, you know, it is called the positivity prescription.
Yes.
And with that comes I think, you know, sometimes that term, you know, being positive or happiness can be a little misconstrued, certainly by perhaps more cynical members of the media who do like to, and even some of our colleagues, you know, who do like to say, like you said before, it maybe is too individualistic, but this idea that we can just be positive, that it's all about positivity and then everything will be okay. What do you mean when you talk about positivity?
So for me, it encompasses, a large part of that is positive emotions, which the science of positive psychology has spent the last 20 years, particularly Professor Barbara Fredrickson's work and others, looking at how they don't just help us feel good, but they affect how we function, which is a really important part of, I guess, if we're going to address some of the world's significant social challenges that we have now. So the positive emotions is a big part. And I hesitate to say I'm not a fan of the term positive thinking. I suggest more optimistic and hopeful thinking, which there's quite a lot of research around solution-focused thinking, which you and I have been trained in coaching psychology as well. And then positive behaviours, if you like. So there's been some great research done on these positive behaviours in workplace settings. So acts of kindness, forgiveness, and gratitude being the three big ones, these positive workplace practices that seem to have a big impact as well. So for me, it sort of encompasses those emotions, behaviours and thought patterns that lead to, I guess, a sense of well-being and also engagement in life and being able to help others around us as well.
So it is so much more than just this kind of feeling and thinking positively, isn't it? What you've described there is a lot of doing. So coming back to Felice Harper's thing about doing good and even the positive emotions for most lay people, I think probably for most of our audience and certainly for me once upon a time, if you know somebody said label a positive emotion, I'd go happiness, fun, joy. But even positive emotions are bigger than that, aren't they?
Absolutely. And again, thanks to Barb Fredrickson's research, she's identified 10 different positive emotions. I won't be able to pop them all off the top of my head right now, but things like awe, you know, when you observe something that's awesome, as often the Americans say, it's awesome. Elevation, this experience of observing some amazing kind act being done and you get that goosebump feeling and this desire to go and do something else. Gratitude, love. So there are much broader than what we've originally understood happiness. So happiness is, I struggle, I guess, with that term because the last thing, again, we'd want people to do is think that it's normal to be happy all of the time. But through our day, week, and I guess lifetime, the ideal is that we are looking for more of these positive emotions. And, you know, the labels, I still struggle a bit with the labels because I say, you know, more positive emotions than negative, but even negative emotions, as you know, can be positive. So, you know, assertiveness being a positive expression of anger and, you know, so, you know, prudence, if you like, or a certain level of fear being important to protect us. So in the book, I've got a whole chapter around mood. And even though positive psychology has typically pretty much focused on positive emotions to sort of balance out from psychology, where I know myself when I was training as a psychologist, I never had a lecture on love or joy or kindness or whatever it was. But in the chapter, again, due to my background in clinpsych, I've always recognized the importance of the full range of human emotions. So even a flourishing individual will still experience appropriate fear and anger and sadness. And that was a really important message that I wanted to get across as well.
I'm glad you struggle with the labels too, because I find myself saying things like negative emotions and having to qualify that and go, not that there's really negative emotions, because you know all the emotions are important. So you mentioned mood. So mood is one of the, you've got six M's in the model that the book follows through, and mood is one of those. Can you talk us just briefly, because we don't want to go through the whole book, obviously, but just really quickly, what are the six M's and how do they work?
So amazing how they all started with M, Ellen, isn't it? So, one of them I had to be a little, use my top strength of creativity with. So mood is the first one where we, as I said before, sort of explore the full range of human emotions. But I do, in the book, focus more so on the promotion of positive emotions, if you like, because again, as psychologists, we're very well trained to help people deal with the negative, if you like, the fear, anger, shame, disgust, and guilt. So part of my mission, and it is in the book as well, is to encourage people to actively seek therapy, treatment. We're all talking about mental health, but I don't think we've seen a translation into people actually accessing therapy. I think there's still a lot of stigma around what that is. So I'd really like to see that change. And sometimes those more challenging and problematic emotions are best helped with a professional. I mean, there are some great self-help resources, which I also make reference to in the book, to help, and particularly in the chapter around mindset, which I'll get to in a moment. But coming back to mood, most of my focus is on how do we actively promote positive emotions to help us not just feel good, but function better, and to improve our relationships as well, because we know that they have a big impact on our relationships. So that's mood. Motivation, we fairly quickly move into the science of motivation. There's so much psychological science, as you know, Ellen, out there.
One of my favourite topics.
Oh, I love it too. particularly looking at our readiness for change, not just assuming that we're at action stage, we might just be contemplating. So sharing some of that research, and then our reasons for change, the why of the goal, which is even more powerful than the what of the goal, as you know. Then we move into might, and that's might is a strength. So that was the one I used a little bit of creativity.
I think you've done well. I think that's a good description of it, you know, might and strength, yeah.
Exactly. So we explore in the main character strengths, because that is an area that I'm really familiar with, that particularly the research shows that when we're developing our character strengths, there's highly correlated with our psychological well-being as well. And then we move into meaning, and as you know, that's a really hot topic right now. Interestingly, though, when I was teaching at Sydney Uni and we had a lecture on meaning, I used to really notice the shift in the emotional climate in the room, because when we were talking about mood and positive emotions, there was lots of joy and laughter. But when we get to the topic of meaning, you would get the full range of human emotions. So I think meaning's a really important topic. We know that it impacts on well-being, but it's not necessarily going to make you yellow, smiley-faced, happy as well, because you know, times it's hard. The things that are meaningful, like caring for people around us that are sick or, you know, aging, it's difficult, but it does impact on our well-being. Then we move into mindfulness, which I know Professor Felicia Huppert and I certainly send the message to, that it's the foundation of flourishing. And in fact, if you haven't got a level of mindfulness, and when I say mindfulness, as you know, there's lots of different ways to conceptualize that. I guess in the very basic setting, some awareness, some very basic awareness of being an observer, because if you can't be an observer of yourself, then it's going to be very hard to apply any of the other M's in the 6M model, if you like. So if you think about strengths, for example, if you're not aware of what your strengths are, or if you're in a situation and you're not thinking about, oh, which strengths could I apply here? So you need the mindfulness to actually bring a lot of these tools to life.
I often talk about paying attention in that, you know, that awareness, paying attention. But you've got a great little model in there, the STOP model, which I don't think I'd seen before. Can you talk us quickly through what STOP stands for?
Fantastic. So basically just stop, take a breath, observe, and proceed. And it's a great little pause, if you like, in your day. We often suggest that educators that are running from class to class do a mindful stop before they go into the next class as well. And it just does help you. I mean, the breath, as you know, kicks in your parasympathetic nervous system. It calms you down. It allows you to observe, how am I feeling? Do I need to take a few more breaths actually to calm myself down? What's going through my mind? And I guess that brings us to the mindset as well, because the stop allows you to observe what types of stories you're telling yourself about, you know, what's going on or what could be happening in, you know, in the next class, if you're a teacher, for example. So we end with mindset because that's a really big part, if you like, of our well-being. And we've known that as psychologists for decades. In fact, it's been the bread and butter of psychologists, is helping people understand their thinking processes and be, as you said, a greater observer of them. I guess I bring both cognitive behavioral techniques in terms of being aware that you can potentially think differently and potentially, you know, challenge and reframe the way you're thinking, but I also make some reference to some of the newer ACT type approaches where you're more of an observer and you let that story go and then you move forward in a values congruent direction, if you like. So I've tried to weave that in. It's a little bit tricky to do both of those, but I've also made reference to great resources. I'm not sure if you've had them on your show yet, but Dr. Sarah Edelman, who her book Change Your Thinking. If I had a dollar for every time I mentioned that, I'd be a very rich woman.
Yeah, actually, that's a good reminder, because I've often suggested her book as a resource for people. It hasn't occurred to me to get her on the show, but that would probably make it a great conversation as well, wouldn't it? I'll put that on my list. Thank you.
Absolutely. I'm sure she's changed a lot of people's thinking, but their lives actually over the years. And then, of course, Dr. Russ Harris and The Happiness Trap is another great, you know, introduction to ACT as a technique for the general public. So they're both mentioned in my book as well.
Mm. Thank you for that. So we've got our six M's there. Can I just take you back particularly to, because we talked a bit about mood in a bit more depth, especially around positive emotion and the role of different emotions. Can I take you back to the might and the strengths?
Yes.
Just quickly, can you tell us a little more? Because for you and I, the language of strengths is just, you know, it's part of our everyday. But perhaps for our listeners, they don't necessarily know, because it's a great tool that people could use. And
Absolutely. For
me, it's been a really informative, for myself personally, informative part of positive psychology as to what are your strengths and how do they work.
Absolutely. And for those people in workplaces, I'm finding increasingly workplaces are adopting a strengths-based approach right through from onboarding even to, you know, people departing throughout placement, which is so fantastic to see. Some of your listeners might be familiar with some of the performance strengths tools like the Gallup Clifton Strengths Finder or Strengths Profile. They're what I'd refer to, and there's a little bit of debate or differentiation as to how we talk about these, but for me, they're more what I'd call a performance strength. So you might not want to develop all of them. With Gallup, there's 34. With Strengths Profile, there's 60. You may not necessarily want to develop them all, particularly if they're not, you know, a top strength. They're more a lesser strength, if you like, but what I've really focused on in the book is the character strength. So this was one of the first, I guess, projects that Professor Martin Seligman had started the positive psychology movement back in 98, him and his colleague, Professor Chris Peterson, who we also lost not too long, a few years ago now, was one of their first projects was to create a classification of character strengths. So there's 24 of these character strengths. The VIA Institute, you can go to, there's so much information and research on there. There's a free assessment, as Ellen mentioned. You can do a paid one for around, I think, $20, which is well worth it because you actually get a lot of suggestions for how to develop potentially your lesser strengths or wind down your top strengths, because strengths can be overplayed as well. But when it's really important when it comes to character strengths, it's not really about just playing to your top five strengths, because these character strengths are all important. The full 24 are all important. And my hope is by the time I've left the planet, Ellen, that I've developed the full 24. I don't say or claim to be there just yet, but it is something. And I know there's a famous story about Benjamin Franklin that went about developing his virtues. He might not have used the same character strengths, but that was something that he did over his lifetime, was to develop. And I recall he gave the list to one of his friends and said, "How did I go?" And his friend said, "Yeah, I'm not sure about modesty and humility."
Well, there'll always be lesser strengths, won't there?
Yeah, so it's a great approach to life. It's being used extensively in schools for children to develop a strengths literacy as part of a broader wellbeing literacy, if you like. And I've also seen it's run through organisations like IBM, and, you know, so it's a great way for people, particularly when you're talking about virtuous organisational citizenship and people being good human beings in organisations, it's a wonderful tool to introduce there as well.
Mm. And can you tell us your top five strengths?
So zest, energy and vitality, although I tell you, Ellen, I don't think I'm at my top right at the moment. I had a tough couple of weeks. But, yeah, generally zest, energy and vitality. And I know when I first discovered it and I said, thought to myself, really? Which is, you know, not uncommon for people to say, really? And I'll normally say, yes, it is a self-report. So you answered it.
Yes.
But I know all of my buddies said, yeah, we call you the pocket rocket. Like, you know, so...
It was there.
Zest, energy, vitality. I've got curiosity, which can sometimes be overplayed. I know my business coach told me I was suffering from SOS, shiny object syndrome, which for me was overplaying curiosity, and love of learning is my other one. Creativity, which again, when I got, I thought, wow, I'm so not an artistic person. I had it, you know, many years ago, I had those sort of connected. And then I realized, yeah, I use my creativity with the science, and I think about how can I present that in our workshops and which bit fits with which bit. So I love the creativity bit. And what have I forgotten? Hope. I'm a high hoper. You'd hope so.
You'd hope so, yes.
As the CEO of the Positivity Institute and as a coach, imagine if I was like, oh, no, I don't think you're ever going to be able to change. So
see, that's a good question. I don't know where hope is. Hope's not in my top five. I hope it's up there somewhere, or maybe I've just done well to develop it. I'm not sure.
Yeah. And look, if you have invested a lot in your self-development and character, and you've perhaps have had some character building experiences in your life, I mean, that's what does develop character as well as actively deciding that you want to develop it. But I've found that most people have at least the top 20 fairly well developed. And then when it comes to the last five, sometimes there's some ahas, particularly around the strength of forgiveness. When, you know, you'll have people look at it as their number 24 and they'll go, yes, I know I'm not a very forgiving person. So if you do the free version, it's really helpful to just hold particularly those bottom five lightly, and it does require some self-awareness to ask yourself, is it really a weakness that I need to develop, or is it perhaps just a lesser strength, if you like? Mm,
or informative. That's interesting. Forgiveness is in my top five.
Oh, that's beautiful.
It's my only humanity strength. All the others are wisdom strengths.
That's good.
Yeah, I've got four wisdom strengths. Curiosity, love of learning, judgment, perspective, and then forgiveness.
Oh, fantastic.
Which, I don't know, strikes me as a weird combo. It doesn't seem to be the norm, but obviously there is no norm.
But yeah, interesting. I like the judgment, which, as you probably know, often people think that they see that negatively. Oh, I've got judgment.
It doesn't sound like a nice term, yeah.
No, but it's actually open-mindedness, critical thinking, and then making good judgments. So I love that strength. I wish more people on the planet had open-mindedness, to tell you the truth, and curiosity.
Yes, it does make things like Twitter and things like that difficult for me, because I'm sort of like, oh, really? Really? You've got to be that black and white about it.
There's so much black and white. I just spoke about this yesterday. I just find that people go to these provocative extremes. You know, there's a fantastic paper out for those that are scientifically inclined on the call, Second Wave Positive Psychology, or Positive Psychology 2.0, by Tim Lomas and Itai Itzvan. We can, you know, send a link. I think it's on ResearchGate, people can access. And I love that paper because it's talking about the dialectic and that flourishing, if you like, and that it's not, again, about positive and negative, but how do we have a broader conception of these, what might appear to be opposites? How do we actually bring those together, you know, for our well-being, if you like?
I think that's one of the things that excites me most about the field, having, again, like you, been involved in it probably right from the beginning, even though I didn't know that's what it was when we started, is seeing where it could take us at a more societal level, you know, if even if we're working with individuals to get a better sense of who we are, how to operate at our best, then you get a critical mass of that, and one would hope that then that starts to flow into our institutions and maps our political system. And I know some of our colleagues are working on, you know, how that might look, but I think that's a really exciting thing for the next 20, 30, 50 years.
So do I, and I'm actually going to the European Positive Psych Conference in Iceland in June this year, and I'm fairly sure it's on their agenda to look at policy and, I guess, broader positive communities. Yeah, so I find all of that really interesting too, and I think the older I get, that's the place I'd like to play more in as well.
Mm. The book, I think, you know, again, if we're talking about that, how do we help individuals and broaden that mission of being able to share some of the language, these skills, because they are really practical skills, and, you know, spread that out to a wider community in the hope that we can all start to play this part in this kind of bigger picture piece.
Exactly.
And one of the things that I loved about the book when I had a flick through it, and you've shared some of them today, is just your own personal stories that you've shared in there about how these things have worked for you. Are there any that kind of stand out that you're happy to share with our listeners to give them a little flavour?
I think they're in the book anyway, and I'll consistently say, when people ask me, like, what are the things that have really made a difference with clients, and I know in my own life, is the values clarification. So as, again, many of the listeners will be familiar with, that's quite a large component of an ACT-based approach. But I have to say that in coaching, when I first started coaching psychology and with Professor Anthony Grant, who we've only just recently lost, we always spoke about values and helping a client articulate what mattered most before setting the goals. And of course, there's a whole body of research around authentic goal setting, self-concordant goal setting. So I think I did my values in my early 30s, and I've only just recently changed them at 50. So they haven't changed much. The language is perhaps a little bit more sophisticated now than what I had before, and a little bit more wiser, I think, now. But once I did that values exercise, and I know with working with many, many clients, they really become, well, one of my clients said, the best decision-making tools he'd ever had in his life. And I developed a bit of an acronym for mine, and which is then makes it really easy to remember them. And then when I'm in a situation, I can bring that to mind and think, how is this aligned to my values? Or I can use my journal. So last year I had some decisions I wanted to make, and I actually took a day on each of my values and I did some journaling around how this decision was aligned to my values or not. And that really helped me significantly. So yeah, the values. And then in conjunction with that, we use this letter from the future, which is a fantastic coaching technique, which I refer to in the book. And again, I did that at 30 to 35, I think I started with, and I got to 35 and it wasn't quite the future that I wanted. So I pushed it out to 40, and then I did 40 to 50. And then I've written another one now, my 60-year-old self, to myself now. So in that, it's not talking about the specifics of where you're living, who you're married to. It's meant to be a fuzzy vision, and it's meant to be have your values woven through it. So it's something like, you know, I wake in the morning, I'm in a relationship where I feel loved and I can share love. I get up and I do work that's really meaningful. And so it's meant to be fuzzy. And so that letter from the future, and I also use a vision board as well to bring, I guess, some of the other things that I would like to see be created in my life. I use that in conjunction. So I'm pretty pedantic about this. So at least once a week, I'll pull out my vision board. Not every week do I pull out the letter from the future. Probably every couple of months I'll bring out the letter from the future. And then the beginning of every year, I set goals. I review my values. I review my letter from the future. And then I set goals for each. I use the life balance wheel, which is in there as well. And I set goals for each of the areas of my life. So I walk and talk this stuff as best as I can, Ellen.
You do. I'm impressed with the level of investment that you, and I'm sort of, as you're talking about it, I'm trying to reflect on what I do, and do I actually put that degree of investment? I'm not sure I do at a really practical level, but maybe because I've still got primary school age children, that gets in the way. But, you know, I think one of the things that I've done the last couple of years, and it's really funny because you talk about that creativity is one of your top strengths. It's not one of my top five, but I do love to create, and I love to create these podcasts and my workshop content, all the stuff that I do. And for some reason, a couple of years ago, at the beginning of the year, when I do sit down and do my, right, what do I want this year to look like in a fuzzy sense, I started drawing it.
Oh, fantastic.
I just had this blank page and I did little drawings. I said, okay, one of the things I really want to do is travel because I feel that's something I've missed. I feel that is part of my curiosity and love of learning is fueled by travel and I value that. So I'm drawing little appallingly drawn pictures of airplanes and
absolutely.
Me doing yoga poses. And what it actually did was probably a little similar to your vision board is I can have it there and again, pull it out every couple of months or something and just look at it and go, oh, how am I actually tracking on these? And they are fuzzy visions. You know, it's just a picture of an airplane. It's not me saying I'm going to fly, you know, take this trip to this place and do these things on these days. It's just the intention really, I suppose, you know, is to take the opportunities when they come or.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, the science, and I do make reference to it in the book as well, it's around the attentional bias. So it's not the secret. It's not like I visualize it and it's there tomorrow, but it does then prime you to look, listen for opportunities that you may not have, you know, focused on if you didn't put that out there in the first place. So there is some science behind it. And there's also some great research around unconscious goal pursuit as well. So again, if you set these goals, then you unconsciously, your brain's still working on it unconsciously as well. So they can be very powerful. They've been very powerful in my life. And the other one is the journal writing, which I first wrote my first journal in 1997. in the early days. So that was in my 30s. They were quite therapeutic in nature. I think when I was, you know, I came through a divorce, and so I was using the journals to work through that process, I think. But they're much more creative now and inspirational now of what I want to do in the remaining part of my life, I guess. So
yeah.
So journals, I couldn't recommend them too highly. I know they're not for everybody, and that's the important thing. You know, again, there's research on person activity fits. So some activities are going to work for others, others may not. But I would suggest, again, through years and years of practice with this, is we usually suggest to clients, you know, do it as a behavioral experiment. Go out there and experiment with it. If it works, fantastic, do more of it. If it doesn't, try something different. But if you have that mindset of, you know, that gratitude stuff isn't going to work for me, then it's not going to work for you. We've got lots of research around self-fulfilling prophecies as well. So hold the ideas lightly, and you might be surprised by just what they can do for you.
Yeah, just test and learn. That's one of my favourite sayings. Just go out, test and learn, see what happens. If it works, great, do more of it. This is another Anthony Grant thing that I still remember from my first year at the coaching. You know, if it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, change it, try something else.
Exactly. Love it.
So glad that you shared a lot of that, Susie, because I think some of those other things that people do struggle with in the translation of, you know, a lot of the coaching stuff, that whether we're doing it one-on-one with somebody or in a book, even something like values, it's not easy to identify what your values are. I think a lot of us feel that we need to, you know, we get presented with a values list, and you've got one here in the book. And and we have to get it right. You know, I have to get this right. And there's no right about it. These are guiding principles, and they're yours. They're personal. You can change them. You can be flexible with them.
They take time.
Yeah.
I had one client say, Susie, I need a year. I need a year to take some time out and really think about what matters most. And that might be the case, you know, but you can, I always say, start off, just tick. I know I asterisk nearly everything when I first did a values, and then I put it aside, come back, put it aside, come back, meditated, went into nature, and eventually you will feel them to be right. And there's, again, some good research by Ken Sheldon a number of years ago, looking at when people reflected on their goals, their authentic goals that were aligned to their core values, that they feel it in their body. You actually get a differentiation in how you feel compared to when you're asked to reflect on a goal that isn't aligned to your values. So I used to say to my clients, once you get, you know, if you say top five, you will get to a point where you feel them to be that this is them. And that's the point you want to get to.
And that brings us back to that awareness, isn't it? You know, unless you are paying attention to what's going on in your body, those feelings, then you can't notice. So it is all wrapped up together.
That's it. And yeah, again, with that mindful observation, you might notice a shift in your body and then be curious enough to say what's going on. And it could be a values conflict or something as well. So, but all of this speaks to the importance of self-awareness and I guess carving out a self-reflective space. Everybody's so busy these days. I know that, but I can't, I guess, and that's part of your message, I think, too, is just how important that can be in terms of your own personal growth and development, but then your impact on the people around you. So trying to carve out, even if it's just brief amounts of time on a regular basis, or going on retreat once a year at least or something like that, but you do need that time to self-reflect, to see how you're going, what, as you said, what you're doing well and what you want to do differently going forward.
And I know you do that very consciously, because I do see, particularly on your Instagram feed, you have, is it Sunday mornings? Is there kind of a time for
Soul Sunday, Self-Care Sunday? I try to do monthly monk day.
That's a nice one. I like that.
Yeah. So, and then you know, I've just did a 7-day retreat in January, which was fantastic. I haven't really done that for myself before. Mm. I've taken 7 days. I mean, I've gone on holidays, but not in an actual sort of retreat. Mm. So that was wonderful too.
Yeah. And so I'm wondering whether this might be preempting my next question, which is, you know, if you've got advice, some tips for someone who might be very interested to engage in some of this stuff, they feel like they need to flourish a little more in their life, but they're feeling scared or reluctant or like it's too hard or it's too big a commitment. Yeah. What's the kind of really simple first step for someone?
Yeah, I think it is baby steps, Ellen, and there's obviously a lot of things you can do in the book. The mindfulness, and I know some people find that very difficult, but there's some fantastic apps out there. And even just starting with a 5-minute, you know, mindfulness meditation every day. I have been asked plenty of times if you had two things to recommend to get a quick boost to your well-being, the research would definitely direct us towards mindfulness, and you'll start to notice a difference relatively quickly, and also gratitude. You know, so in the studies that have been done, in less than a month, just once a week, consciously stopping and acknowledging the things that you do have rather than what you don't have. And that's heartfelt. It has to be a heartfelt sense of appreciation, not just a write down my five things. It's got to really be heartfelt to get the boost. So I wouldn't try and do everything. I'd start, I know for myself personally, when I went on my own self-help journey, it was the journaling that made a difference, and the gratitude that made a big difference to me in the early days.
Interesting. And I would say, I'm just kind of think what it is. For me, probably the awareness and mindfulness, the stopping and pausing every once in a while to notice what's happening in your mind, to notice what's happening in your body, to notice your energy levels. And I've probably come to that largely through a long history of yoga.
Yes.
And then see, gratitude, I've always struggled with a little bit.
Maybe you're already grateful.
Well, maybe. That's what I was just wondering, whether maybe that was something. Yeah. I think that was part of maybe the culture of my family growing up. So maybe it was already there to some extent.
Yeah, because the research has shown, like, yeah, if you're already high on gratitude, you're not going to get an extra boost by engaging in these activities. But if you're quite low, and I've seen this in my workshops where people have had big ahas that it's in their bottom five, and then we play, you know, quite a powerful video around gratitude. I had one man come back in the next session and just said, oh my goodness, I went straight home and told my wife and children that I love them. You know, I realized that I'd been taking them for granted. So for people that have perhaps been taking people or things, their life for granted, it is so powerful to have a bit of a aha around, wow, life is short, people aren't here forever, and look how lucky we are generally, when I'm talking about where we live, we're pretty fortunate to be where we are.
Yeah. So we'll get on to final question, which is, where can our listeners get hold of a copy of the Positivity Prescription?
Yeah, fantastic, Ellen. So it's being launched the week of 9th of March, and you can purchase it directly from our website, but it will also be on Amazon as well, and hopefully in bookstores in time to come. We're working on that at the moment. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. So I will put a link to your website, which I would put anyway, but I will make sure I put a link exactly to the book so that listeners can go straight there and click and order their copy. Great that it's on Amazon as well, because that gives a lot of flexibility, particularly, I'm guessing, to our international listeners too, because you and I are both here in Australia. I also put a link to some of that, because you've mentioned quite a bit of fantastic research there. And, you know, for anybody who is interested in kind of delving into a bit more of the science, thank you for sharing those, because I'll put a link for those as well into the show notes for the episode, as well as your social media feed, so people can find where you are and they can see, because that's one of the things that I really enjoy, is actually being able to kind of see all of this work, this investment that you make in yourself, because as we said right at the beginning, you know, this is practical stuff. And to see that in action through your exercise, your routines, your journaling, your time out, your retreats. I personally think that a lot of that zest comes through in your social media feed, because I was like, oh, Susie's somewhere else. Look what she's doing. She's out with people. it's a very, but I think that's a wonderful reflection. I think if people really want to see what living a flourishing life looks like, because I know that this is not just you having this wonderful life. I know that there's intention behind that. You created this, you know, and I'm sure there are days when you don't feel like going out and doing stuff, but you say, right, I'm going to go out and do this because I know this is what is important.
Yeah. And I guess the research, and I refer to it in the book, it's called Prioritizing Positivity. So they found that there are individual differences between people, and those that do make an effort to do the activities, which in many cases involve spending around our relationships, you know, quality time as well, do report high levels of well-being. But you do need to be quite intentional about that.
I think that's perfect, prioritizing positivity, because that is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Making it a priority in our lives and not just getting on with the day to day and hoping that all of that stuff falls into place, because we know that's not how it works.
No, it certainly doesn't.
Susie, thank you so much for your time and everything that you shared today. I've really, really enjoyed it. It's always a great reminder for me of some of the science that I'm not always totally across.
Yeah, there's so much. Give me some tips.
Yep. There is so much. But also, you know, just being able to share all of that in a practical sense for our listeners to be able to kind of take that on board and hopefully go away. And I'm quite sure that we have made our contribution to increasing the flourishing in our community. So. And then by everybody engaging in a little bit more of some of this stuff, then that ripple effect will grow.
Absolutely. That's my hope, Ellen. So thank you. And thank you for the work that you do. It's so important.
You're very welcome. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's an easy one for me. It's a no-brainer.
Yeah. Fabulous. Thank you again so much, Susie.
I mean it when I say that Susie lives and breathes wellbeing and positivity. Check out her Instagram page to see it all in action, from her retreats to her strengths in action to her zest for life and her courage in trying new things, as well as her work with the Positivity Institute, so helping schools and workplaces to thrive and to flourish. And we've put a link to Susie's social channels and the Positivity Institute in the show notes for this episode. There you'll also find a link to find out more and buy your copy of The Positivity Prescription, a 6-week wellbeing program based on the science of positive psychology. It is out now, released this week, and all of those links are at potential.com.au/podcast. Now, I didn't mention it in the intro today, but my free webinar on personality, what it is, can we change it, and what role does it play in our motivation, is coming up. It's on Monday the 16th of March at 10 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. And the link to register is also in the show notes. And of course, if you register, but you can't attend because you're on the other side of the world, or because you're busy that morning, or for whatever other reason, if you register, I will send you a link to the recording after we've gone live. So if you attend live, you can ask me questions. I can coach you through some challenges. It's lots of fun. You get to meet some other members of the PP community. But if you can't make it, still register and we'll send you the recording. And of course, if you can't attend, but you have a question that you'd like me to answer, you might like to shoot that through to me in advance, and then I'll answer it on the webinar and you can watch it later. So my email address is ellenjackson@potential.com.au. Okay, so what is up next week? Well, I will be talking to Naomi Hunter and Jeremy Hunter from Empowering Resources, and we're talking about children's books. And not just any children's books, but the carefully curated selection of books that Empowering Resources publish to start empowering conversations with our kids about difficult topics. Here's Jeremy to tell you a little bit more.
The most amazing impact that the book had is within the first 3 months of its release, 10 young girls disclosed abuse while reading it. And that for us was just so amazing. We had many nights just crying in devastation for these kids, but so amazed and grateful that the book had reached them. And I still remember that first day where we heard about this first young girl. You know, during the reading of the book, the little girl just said, "This has happened to me." And when we heard that, it was all worth it.
So I have a beautiful stack of their books on my desk, and I will admit to a few tears in the office as I read through each of them. The books are amazing, but the story behind how they came to be in the world is even more so. So you're going to hear all about that next week. It's episode 77 of the Potential Psychology Podcast, and my interview with Naomi Hunter and Jeremy Hunter from Empowering Resources. But until then, have a fantastic week. Go forth, thrive, flourish, and fulfill your potential. And I'll see you soon.